Hello and welcome to the long-awaited premiere episode of the Book Wars podcast, your new Star Wars book club. I'm Chris, and I'm here with Kate and Kristen, and if you've been waiting 2 weeks to hear our inaugural episode, that's because we are re-recording it because of technical difficulties, because we, unfortunately, our technology is
much more similar. Stupid.
Well, it's so stupid. Our technology is also more similar to the Rebel Alliance than the Empire. We'll put it that way.
I think that's pretty fair. I'm Kristen. I'm coming to you all from Portland, Oregon, where it is already very hot out and not raining, which is very strange. And y'all are in Arlington, Virginia.
Yep.
So that's the other reason that we have it's kind of a high level of difficulty. We're not only is this kind of my first foray into podcasting, but we're also trying to do it across the country. So that's what happens.
It's a little bit challenging. But
yeah, so you all get to witness episode one, take two. Hopefully it is even better than the first time.
Especially because now I know that Chris is recording his own track for us to splice together instead of our first stab at this, where the only audio we had of Chris was my stupid microphone picking up what was coming in through my headphones.
Which is pretty fun and challenging. Yep. No, it wasn't. Yeah. It was horrible.
No.
And I wanted to die.
Yep. So
anyway, back to the podcast, as you get kind of a glimpse into how this podcast is going to go with someone going on tangents and then you reining them back in.
Yep.
Mostly Chris.
The whole podcast.
Chris reining us back in, really. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Basically, the point of this podcast is there's this whole new canon series of media that the Star Wars universe and Disney and Lucasfilm are putting together to really go along with the movies in a way that has never been done before, and really trying to make it a multimedia empire and a multimedia universe. And we want to take a look at, you know, the non-movies, the non-TV shows, the ones that aren't screen-based, and just see what they add to the universe as a whole and the storytelling.
Yeah, and obviously that's going to start first with the books, just because there is so much book content, which is really great. But we will be dabbling into the comic books. We'll probably have some folks who are more familiar with the video games on as guests later. But yeah, I mean, we really wanted to take the opportunity, since we're all pretty big Star Wars nerds, to see what Disney is doing with the franchise, and we think it's really interesting, especially compared to the shit fire that was Lucasfilm before Disney bought them. So anyway,
that's a great segue into we're only going to be handling the canon books. We're not going to be reading the extended universe for a couple reasons. One, because there's a lot of it. There's way too much, and to be honest, most of it sucks.
Much of it sucks. Kate doesn't want to, and she's the boss.
That too.
I mean, it's so help me if I have to read the book with Han Solo punching a giant otter, because I will lose my shit and start screaming.
Mm. Yep. Happy wife, happy life, folks.
Every time you say that, I'm like, I would like to read about that, but you know, that's just me. I can do that on my own time.
You can. We can release a special episode all about Kristen and the giant otter.
So what are y'all drinking
that'll,
today?
That'll be for people
early in the day, so.
Oh, yes. We're
it's noon. Are you drinking anything, Chris?
I am. I am drinking a bourbon ginger with Eagle Rare Kentucky bourbon, which is actually better than I thought it was going to be, because the ginger's kind of...
Eagle Rare is delicious.
Eagle Rare. Well, Eagle Rare is good. I just, you know, it's usually something I'll have in more of a cocktail than just a whiskey ginger. But the ginger's really bringing out the vanilla notes in the bourbon. I'm a fan.
It's awesome. it's noon here, and it's also, I have, just full disclosure, I have the Timbers footy game on in the background, as it is rivalry day. So they're playing Seattle, and we're already losing, so I'm drinking Rainier, and also a lime LaCroix.
Nice.
So, about you, Kate?
I am currently double fisting Earl Grey tea because I'm still asleep, even though it's 3 in the afternoon here, and a gin and tonic.
Perfect. Just uppers and downers for all.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I've also started new meds this week, so, you know, that's good. It's all good.
Yeah. Party. Anyway. Yeah, party.
All right. So now on to the actual book content. I promise that future episodes, once we... Now that we've introduced the podcast and know a little bit about us and what you're going to be listening to, future podcasts will get started a little quicker. But we love hearing book banter anyway.
Promise.
That's what you're
Absolutely.
So basically, for those who haven't been following us on Twitter, at BookWarsPod, totally follow us. The first book that we've been reading is New York Times bestseller, Rebel Rising, by Beth Rivas. And this is, for those who don't know, a book about Jyn Erso in between that first scene of Rogue One where Krennic and the Death Troopers come and kidnap her father and kill her mother, and the next scene in Rogue One, basically, where we cut to adult Jyn in prison. It's basically about what happens in those intervening... What do we decide it is? 15 years? 15 years.
15 years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we're going to handle the first half in this episode, the second half in our second episode, which we'll be recording right after this, because we need to re-record that as well. Thanks, technology.
Party.
But I think the first kind of overarching question that arises when you're reading Rebel Rising is, how does the book change how we see Jyn, and particularly in the first half? And as a reminder to us, since we already recorded, we're basically going to be talking about up through the attack on Tanjai Prime.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, everybody, in case y'all didn't realize by now, this is not a spoiler-free podcast, so...
It's all spoilers, the whole podcast.
Yes, the whole podcast is spoilers. If you're looking for reviews of the book, you know, spoiler-free summaries and things like that, this is not your podcast, please find another one.
Yeah, and another great reason to follow us on Twitter and also just listen to the podcast, we're going to be telling you exactly where we're reading to every week. So, A, so you can follow along and send us questions on Twitter and really join the conversation, because we would love to join you, talk to you about it. But B, so that you can know exactly what we're going to be talking about and, like, if we're going to spoil anything.
Which
Absolutely. We are.
Yeah.
So we should just call
this. Cool. So anyway,
Book Wars spoilers.
How does the book change how y'all see Jyn?
Oh man. Well, she obviously, there's a lot more characterization of her since we get this whole novelization of this time period. I guess it's not really a novelization; it's just a novel. But She's a lot more rich in character, and you understand why she's so kind of jaded by the time we see her in Rogue One, in a way that I think it really filled in a lot of blanks for me as far as explaining who she is when we see her for the first time, or the second, you know, later in her life in Rogue One. But yeah, I mean, she's much more fleshed out than I was even hoping. I don't quite know what I was expecting, because this is my first Star Wars book that I've read. But I just really enjoyed, I enjoyed kind of reading the backstory that Rivas put together for her. I think she did a great job.
Yeah, definitely. I also think what's interesting is, you know, we, obviously the movie flashes from Jyn being 8 years old, I believe, to her being this super jaded 23-year-old, and, just to, you know, and we know from the movie that she ran with Saw Gerrera's band of rebels for a while, you know, and it just, the book really fills in that dichotomy in Jyn's character and that character arc where she goes from pretty, not almost innocent, but also, you know, idealistic, and then just bringing out how she went from that to just how we see her in the movie. Super jaded, super not interested in the rebellion, super not interested in getting involved in anything at all besides surviving, you know?
Yeah, totally. I think that one thing that the book really did for me is, one, criticism that you sometimes heard of the movie, which I don't know that I necessarily agreed with, but a lot of people said that Jyn was a character who you couldn't really tell what her motivation was. She started off very, you know, fuck you, I don't care about anything. I'm British, like, you know.
I'm space British. Great.
I'm
I'm so many space Brits.
But no, like, she started off as very devil may care. Like, I don't care about anything. Everything is stupid to me. And then, you know, kind of the switch flips and she turns into this rebel, you know, through and through, and wanting to do things for the galaxy. Rebellions are built on hope. And you kind of, you know, I thought you could get a sense of that transition in the movie, but you definitely get a sense of it here, because at least in the first half, when we're dealing with young Jane until she's about 15 or 16, I think, around 8 to 15, you get young in all senses. I mean, obviously the physical sense, but emotionally, she's very young. She is dealing with the fact that she thinks that her father abandoned her to work for the Empire. She, you know, Saw is the only father figure that she really knows at this point, and he's not a good father. Like, he doesn't know what he's doing, self-admittedly.
He's a terrorist.
And he's also a terrorist, and so you have that kind of moral ambiguity to her, but you have her struggling with this concept of, you know, wanting to do things that will help the galaxy, that will help defeat the Empire, and thinking that what she does matters, as opposed to, you know, nothing matters, why are we even trying, that attitude that you kind of see, particularly on first scene on Yavin, and then also at the beginning of Jedha in Rogue One. So what's been really interesting is, A, seeing where that idealism deep in her comes from, but B, we haven't yet seen how she gets from young Jin to Rogue One Jin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with everything Chris said. Yeah, I get really frustrated when people are, I mean, this is not a movie criticism podcast, but I get really frustrated when people talk about the characterization in Rogue One. Like, it's a standalone movie. You have to cram so much damn characterization in there. It's already a long movie. Like, I think.
Yeah, besides the fact that the movie itself is, like Jin's clearly one of the two main characters, but also it's an ensemble movie. You're telling everyone's mm-hmm. backstory.
Yeah, and.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's kind of the beauty of the Star Wars universe, because, like, in, like, the past, you know, obviously you've had this giant expanded universe that a lot of authors were working on, but it was very separate from the movies. It was, the movies are the movies, and everything else exists in the background. Whereas I think what you see Lucasfilm doing now is, you have this whole interconnected world where the movies are important, but you're gonna see shit in Star Wars Rebels, that's currently on Disney XD, which is allegedly kind of a children's show, but it's really not.
Okay, it's not really a children's show. Fans.
So not.
It's really not a children's show.
It's not a children's show. I mean, yeah, people do still make fun of us.
I mean, it's marketed as a children's
it, but...
show.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but you get that sense that everything, you know, obviously the movies are still the movies. Like, the yeah. movies are Star Wars. And that's, nothing is ever gonna reach that level. But everything else is important, and you get that sense that when you're reading, you know, this book, Rebel Rising, that, like, you know, is ostensibly a YA book, although we're going to go into that a little later.
Yes.
And maybe in a future episode. But ostensibly a YA book, you know, one that not necessarily a ton of people would be talking about or know about, if, you know, there weren't this big press push behind it. And you really are getting the support from Lucasfilm to push this book, and the feeling that, like, this book is, and I know many of the Lucasfilm story group hate this word, but it's canon. Like, this is Jin's history. This is a historical document in the Star Wars universe. And the movie, you know, this was drawn from the movie, obviously, because the movie was filmed first, but they tie into each other in a way that Lucasfilm is totally fine with, and they say, yes, this is Jin's motivation, this is Jin's history. And I think that's something we didn't have before.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's incredible, after having read this book and then watching Rogue One again, how much it really just enriches the storyline, especially, you know, we were mm-hmm. talking a little bit about Jin's views on her father and how those evolved over the course of her life. And just that scene on Edu where, you know, she's finally reunited with her dad, then he just dies, and it's just like, oh, it's like, it's completely heart-wrenching. It's you know, she spent her entire life thinking that he had abandoned her and just, you know, decided that the Empire was more important than her, and then you have this heart-wrenching reunion where, you know, he says he has so much to tell her and he has so much to explain and apologize for, and so does she, and they never really get get that. It adds so much.
Yeah, I totally agree. Because I think before this, Rogue One didn't totally make clear that Jin was under the impression that her dad abandoned her, right? She was She was kind of operating under, you know, we didn't really at least get that part of the story. So that was one of the more striking facts to me when I was thinking about how this changed how I see Jin, just in that, how can you live your life thinking that, like,
right,
that must have fucked her. I mean, it obviously did fuck her up a lot, but it's like such a thing.
Totally. Like, the closest thing we get in the movie is that she, you know, when she is first taken into the rebellion, she tells Mamatha, "I like think my father's dead," which is telling in and of itself. But having all of the backstory behind it, it just makes it that much more powerful. You know, especially that moment where they tell her, "Like, your father sent us a secret message with a defector telling us, you know, the Empire's secrets and about the super weapon that they're building." It's kind of incredible because Beth Reeves invented this whole backstory for Jin after the movie took place, and I don't know how much of it was told to Felicity Jones while she was actually doing the filming, but she just did such an amazing acting job that moment where she hears about her father supporting the rebellion, and it's just like, you can just see all the gears in her head going, just like, oh my god, my entire life is a lie, you know?
Or just everything, yeah, totally. Everything like, that I have not believed in to this point, because I don't really want to say everything that I've believed in to this point, but everything that I've not given a shit about at this point, it was kind of not justified, you know, the way that I was justifying being, you know, living my life just for myself, totally kind of flipped for her, which I think is an awesome thing about the book. So I think let's return a little bit, since we do have some notes in here to talk about the Clone Wars episodes and Saw, since we did talk about the Rebels cartoon a little bit. I think this is plug to finish the Clone Wars. Anyway, but I know you guys
finished the Clone Wars.
Finished the Clone Wars. But I know you guys. You guys rewatched some of this.
Yes.
We did. So, I think, like, obviously, just as a little bit of background, like, obviously, other than Jin, one of the main characters in Rogue One and in Rebel Rising, is Saw Gerrera, who, you know, fans of the not the movie, fans of the movies wouldn't necessarily know him, but if you've seen the Clone Wars on Cartoon Network, or more likely on Netflix since then. If you've seen Disney XD's Star Wars Rebels since then, you're very familiar with Saw Gerrera. He's the former Rebel from Onderon. And in Rogue One, obviously, he's Saw, and he's, like, a big deal, and also kind of crazy.
Kind of crazy.
One thing that really struck me in this book is seeing that character arc, because, on the one hand, who we see in Clone Wars to Rebel Rising to Rogue One is a very different character. Like, it's, you know, he's, obviously in Rogue One, he's crazy. Like, and he's paranoid, and he thinks that everyone is out to get him. And he is, you know, to quote Mon Mothma, he's an extremist. But
he's a terrorist.
Even in Rebel Rising, he's a terrorist, basically. But even in Rebel Rising, and as far back as Clone Wars, you really do see that streak in him. Like, obviously in Clone Wars, he's much more idealistic. He still has his sister Steela kind of operating as his moral conscience. But you still see him have that view of terrorism isn't terrorism if you're fighting for a cause.
Right, exactly. I mean, you definitely see it when they're doing, in Clone Wars, when the Onderon rebels are doing all that street fighting. You know, he really does want to take it to the streets. He doesn't care about the collateral damage or anything like that. He just wants to sock it to the Empire, basically, however he can. And if that means using the Empire's fear tactics, then he's totally fine with that. And you see, especially in the Clone Wars, how that gets checked, as Chris said, by Steela, but also by the Jedi surrounding them, who are training these rebels to fight. By the other rebels in his group, they elect Steela to be their leader instead of Saw, even though Saw was kind of modeled himself as their de facto boss and everything like that. But as soon as Steela dies, you know, that thread kind of snaps for him. I think he says at one point, you know, the Jedi are trying to comfort him at Steela's funeral, and they're kind of holding her up as a martyr. How they're, you know, they and the Onderon rebels are never going to forget her, and they're going to use her memory to fight. And Saw's just kind of not having it. Like, he sees how kind of cold-blooded, honestly, that is, and he takes that to heart, and that never really leaves him. And you see that in very clearly in the book. You see it in when he returns in Rebels, how that mindset has kind of twisted him. And you definitely see in Rogue One at the end of his life when, yeah, he just assumes that, you know, his entire life is just death and dying and running away from it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You get the sense of about Shaw in Rebel Rising is that this is a man who holds a grudge.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Like,
he talks about how, I mean, A, he still blames himself for Steela's death, because, you know, in Clone Wars, Steela's killed when he shoots down a droid gunship and it crashes into the cliff that Steela's standing on and kills her. Which, you know, I mean, I think many people would agree that that is not his fault.
I mean, he blames himself,
but he also, like he says, he blames the Jedi. He blames the Jedi for dropping her, because Ahsoka Tano was standing on the cliff with Steela, and she survives, and she tried to save Steela, you know, using the Force to lift her up, but then she was shot in the process and dropped Steela. And Saw has never forgiven them for that. So you kind of see Saw doesn't really have these ties to, you know, the light, the good side, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't revere the Jedi because they failed him. You know, he doesn't revere, there's no institutions on Onderon that he reveres because, you know, there was the false king on Onderon, and then there was the Empire, and he's been fighting people all his life.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting, I totally agree with Kate, you know, he's willing to, quote, do anything, right? It's not terrorism if it's for a cause. He's willing to do anything except for join up with another band of rebels, because he trusts no one, right? So we see time and again. Well, and I think that was, whenever Jyn brought it up in the book, that she thought Saw would be a good leader, I was like, why? her reflections on that, I think, were some of the most interesting points for me. Her saying, you know, we need a leader. If they're going to be a real band of rebels to get together and actually fight the Empire, Saw needs to be the leader. But obviously Saw himself didn't believe that. I honestly thought that was kind of confusing, just because he's so him. But he trusts nobody, so it's also not that surprising.
Right. At the end of the day, I mean, Saw says that he wants to overthrow the Empire, but at the end of the day, at a certain point, Saw's just kind of out for himself. I just keep thinking about that bit of Rogue One right before he dies, and the Death Star's already destroyed Jedha City, and there's that shockwave that's coming towards the Partisan's hideout. And Saw's like, yeah, you go. It's fine. It's my time to die. And I'm like, all right, cool, but what about the rest of your bros who are just living in your, like, weird shack? He just doesn't give a fuck.
He seriously doesn't.
Yeah, he never really, like, that's one thing that he really, after Steela dies, he doesn't understand the concept of being part of a group and being part of family. I mean, even with Jyn, like, you see in the fact that he abandons her on Tantive Prime, he doesn't understand the concept of family, really. Like, he says to, you know, when Jyn and Saw meet each other again, and there's a lot in that scene. There's a lot more in that scene than meets the eye, but, like, upon the first viewing of it. But he says, are we not still friends? And on the one hand, you know, he took care of her for seven, eight years.
Yeah.
You know, he took her in. He was like a father to her.
Yeah, I mean, he literally says, like, you know from the book, but he does love her. Mm-hmm. Like, Jin thinks that she sees love in his eyes, like, when he's proud of her, and he immediately identifies as her father.
He also just murders people that figure out who she is, which is what I look for in a parent.
Yep.
That's not a bad segue into, I think we're gonna get into comparing Saw and Anakin a little bit, but since we're talking about bad parenting, why did Jin's family leave her with Saw?
Because
nobody else that they trusted?
Star Wars is literally full of terrible parents.
Oh God.
It, like, Saw's a horrible parent figure, but the Aristos are also kind of terrible parents, like... If you think about it, I just keep thinking about that the bit where Lyra goes back and to have her little 5-second showdown with Krennic, and I'm just like,
you could have
you're
not
supposed
do
to
that.
Be taking
yes.
your kid. Please, like, take your kids. Like, you know, they're not going to kill Galen because they need him. So maybe take your kid to your hideout and, like, deal with that.
Instead of just, like, selfishly being like, no. Okay, it's like several stormtroopers, lots of blasters. She's like, I can deal with this. I got it. Like, on what planet?
Totally fine. I know.
Pisses me off, man.
Oh, man. Like, this podcast is not supposed to be, like, telling people how to parent your children. But if it were me, that is not a decision I would make.
Correct.
But, I mean, Star Wars has just this hysterically long history of terrible parenting. I mean, you see this again about, like, parents just, like, not actually giving a flying fuck about their kids over and over in Star Wars, especially if you think about Anakin and Padme. Like, you have that, you know, Padme, like, gives birth to the twins and she has no will to live because Anakin's evil, so she just, like, decides to just kick the bucket, which is...
Yeah,
which
that
is
was
what?
So...
we have feelings. But also, you know, you have that simultaneous scene in episode 3 where, as the twins are being born, you know, Darth Vader is quote unquote being born. And as soon as Vader, you know, is all set up with his apparatus and everything, you know, he's just like, how is Padme? Is she alive? And Palpatine's like, nah. And he's just like, well, damn it. And he's just like, never asked about his kids, like, if they survived the. Like her dying or whatever.
He really doesn't care about that.
Yeah, seriously. And, you know, to say nothing about, you know, cutting your son's arm off, blowing up your daughter's adopted planets, you know,
et cetera, et cetera.
And I think that one thing that you really get from Jin and Saw in Rebel Rising is that, you know, obviously there's the parent dynamic, but even more than that, it's really a master apprentice mm-hmm. dynamic. You mm-hmm. have that tension between them. Like, you have obviously. Saw refers to himself as Jin's father. Jin doesn't necessarily see that. She sees him as a teacher, as a mentor, but she always kind of tenses up when he refers to himself as her father, and you kind of get, you know, the long history of tense master-apprentice relationships in Star Wars. Obviously, the most famous one probably is Obi-Wan and Anakin, but you also have Vader and the Emperor, who had a very contentious relationship, particularly if you read some of the Darth Vader comics and some of the books about Darth Vader, which we'll definitely get into in future episodes. But the master-apprentice dynamic is not a mm-hmm. loving one, and it's not a parenting one. It's very much one based on knowledge, and based on power, and based on, like, what can I get out of this person? And you kind of do get a sense of that in Rebel Rising, because, again, bringing it back to Saw, when he's like, are we not still friends? Because to him, he's like, I taught you everything. I knew you would be, you left me in a bunker. I knew you would be safe. To him, that's fine. Like,
right.
He,
like,
you know, I left you on a planet that, you know, the Empire is in the middle of lighting on fire, but I knew you'd be safe. It's fine. Why are you mad?
Yeah, it's totally cool. Like, his idea of parenting is he gave Jin everything she needed to survive. He didn't necessarily give her love. He certainly doesn't help her education. She makes a point of saying that, but, he gave her everything she needed to drive, so they're totally good. It's totally fine.
Yep.
Everything is great.
Yep.
But also, you know, he definitely... Sorry, Keith.
No, I was just gonna say, it's making me laugh, because, like, I was not a history person, but I'm like, lol, this is like when our parents' generation was raised by parents who lived through the Great Depression. And they're just like, what? You have a house? What are you bitching about?
Right?
You're
so worried about that.
Yeah, I mean, Jin and Saw very clearly have a very different understanding of what it means to be a parent.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because obviously Saw kind of sees himself as a parent, but he's not. Like, it's like, what's the first thing he does with Jin? He's like, okay, wake up, we're going to go outside and, like, wrestle with droids that are no longer droids. Like, that's not a normal...
Yeah. No. What and I also, you know, it's
my first activity with my kid.
And also, like, I mean, well, it's clear that Saw cares for Jin, otherwise, like, I mean, it's Saw, we know that if he didn't give a fly fuck, he wouldn't give him the time of day. Yeah. But he also definitely sees her as useful. Mm-hmm. You know, like, when she's 8 years old, he, like, picks her up off of Lamu. He, like, sticks her in the shuttle, and he's just, like, immediately just starts interrogating her, like, what was your father working on? You know, it's like, one day, and he almost keeps her around to hear about all of his investigations into Galen's research into kyber crystals, because he hopes that one day he'll be able to, like, turn her upside down and shake her by the ankles, and maybe some grain of information will fall out of her. And then he discovers that, this kid is, you know, the daughter of two scientists. Maybe she's actually smart. Let's have her, you know, forging papers for us. You know, she's pretty good with a blaster. Let's have her tag along on a mission with us. And while he does, to a certain extent, try to preserve her from going on these missions and protect her, at the end of the day, he's still using her.
Yeah, and, I mean, and she gets to the point where she ends up wanting to go on the missions, right? And it's like, oh, that's, like, the only successful thing that he, like, he tried to get her to become a fighter, and she is one now. Great. You did it.
And what do you all think Saw's goal is? Because, like, you see, like, when they're on Onderon in the Clone Wars, he has a goal, right? Like, he has freedom for Onderon. He says specifically, terrorism isn't terrorism if you're fighting for freedom or something to that effect. And that's certainly a questionable ideal, but he has a goal, right? And then you see in Rogue One, he doesn't really have a goal. He just wants to cause the Empire pain. Like, he doesn't have an overarching goal. And you see that in, like, Rebel Rising too, because, like, he doesn't really want to join the Rebels. Like, will it be helpful? Will it have a better chance of achieving actual results? Probably, because numbers are power in war, but, like, he doesn't really have a goal. You see from Onderon where they're trying to free people, going all the way to the scene on Inusagi where Saw and his rebels murder innocent people. Like, there's no way around it. That is an absolute terrorist attack, and he does not care.
No, all Saw cares about at this point is fucking shit up.
That's right. I'm killing people who realize who Jin is. He really likes to do that. He's really into it.
Yeah. Speaking of people who like to fuck shit up, one thing that was really evident to me in Rogue One in particular, but particularly in this book and in the Clone Wars, is the comparison between Saw and Anakin Skywalker. And, like, in the Clone Wars, obviously, you see Anakin being the Jedi who's kind of advocating for support to the Onderon rebels. You see, he actually, like, has a fight with Obi-Wan about, like, Obi-Wan's like, we can't help them, and Anakin's like, why not? Like, Obi-Wan's like, this is terrorism. Like, you can't just, like, sponsor insurgents, that's terrorism. And Anakin's like, they're on our side, who cares? Like, so you kind of see that moral relativism that is ultimately Anakin's downfall, because, you know, from his point of view, the Jedi are evil. No, but...
Okay, but also, can we have a minute for the fact that Anakin fucking sent his, like, 6-year-old Padawan through a pirate some fucking, missiles so that she could help the rebels on Onderon?
Yeah, that was...
That was pretty peak.
That was pretty typical Anakin Skywalker.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, you see that the kind of degeneration of both Saw and Anakin. Like, by Rogue One, obviously, Vader is Vader in Rogue One, but you see even Saw, like, he's part robot. Like, he doesn't have feet anymore. He has to breathe using a respirator. Like, in, like, which, you know, they put the, I don't know, the sound effect of Darth Vader's ventilator in there, too.
Oh, yeah,
just to kind of show that, like, Saw may have started, like, as somebody who was ostensibly good, or at least thought he was doing good, but he's changed. Like, he's devolved into, you know, obviously the dark side is specific to the Force, but he's devolved into somebody who is not a good person anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he even asked it, he swings from, aren't we still friends, to, did they send you here to kill me?
Yeah. It's very trusting. Yeah. It's very.
Yeah, it's just like, that's complete 180.
He has some mood swing issues. Maybe a couple, 1 to 2.
I mean, it's not just totally normal to sick like a brain off of some people?
Yeah, I mean, this also made me think interesting things about the folks who are living with him when we see them on when he's like at his hideout before when Jin goes to see him.
Ray.
I feel like earlier in his life when Jin was still around, it probably wasn't like so insanely like seedy and just like a free for all.
Yeah.
And now it's just like everybody is gambling. What are these people actually doing? Are these the same people who are supposed to be helping? They don't look like very good helpers. They look like people who are just like fugitives who need some place to stay.
I know, they've just got Twilight porn going on in the background. I'm like, what is this?
I know.
Yeah, I mean, you really do see that, a kind of abandonment of a goal. Like, on Rey, they're planning. You know, they're saying, these are the ships we can hit. This is how we can cause pain to the Empire. On Jeddah, you have, let's go raid some motherfuckers. Alright, cool, let's just come back and, you know, fuck around. Like, let's go raid some motherfuckers again. Like, you don't have that sense of purpose and that sense of accomplishment. Like, you have, you know, it really is apparent the difference between Saw now in Rebel Rising that Beth Reavis wrote, like the character that Beth Reavis wrote, versus the Saw in Rogue One, and you really see that development of him and how it happened.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's such a... I mean, it's really interesting the way that the director decided to show all these scenes of the Rebel Alliance and how organized they are. You know, obviously they have all those, like, boards with the technology, and then you have got Saw is basically his fucking gambling den. And just the... Also the contrast between the, you know, the Rebels have this base so that they can, you know, monitor what's going on, theoretically, in other parts of the galaxy, and then, like, have this centralized place where they can work outward from there. Saw's just focused on Jeddah and fucking shit up Jeddah, so...
Yeah. I mean, this is...
Not handy.
This is definitely not the last we'll probably talk about Saw, but we've all read the rest of the book at this point, and we do know this is the last that we see of him in the book, is in the first half. So, interestingly enough, his bad raising of Jin has a ripple effect throughout her life, which we will get into. But this is the last that we physically see of him in the story firsthand before we get to Rogue One. So that's a good thing to note, because he kind of just says, I'll come back for you, and then doesn't. So that's how he leaves.
Yeah, and I think that there definitely is still a lot missing. Mm-hmm. I think that there definitely is still a lot missing in Saw's life, and hopefully I know we have Inferno Squad coming out later this year from Delray Books, which deals with the Partisans after the explosion of the Death Star, but you know, maybe it'll deal a little bit with what we know about Saw's life before that, too. So I think we can probably call it there for episode one. We're going to be recording episode two right after this, because we need to record everything. But we hope you've enjoyed. We hope that this has been like an interesting discussion to listen to, talking about this intersection between the books and the movies, and what the books add to the Star Wars universe, and I think we can just leave it there, and hopefully by the time you listen to this episode, episode two will be up. If not already, then within a day or so later. So,
yeah, that's the plan.
Until then, we're gonna... Oh, and for those who haven't read next episode, we're gonna be running through chapter 26 all the way through to the end of Rebel Rising. So, until then, this is Chris signing off for Kate and Kristen as well. Thank you for listening to the Book Wars podcast.
Yeah, hit us up at Book Wars Pod on Twitter. And we would love to...
Oh yeah, at Book Wars Pod on Twitter, bookwarspod@gmail.com. send us questions, send us comments, rate and review,
send us pre
SoundCloud, iTunes, wherever podcasts are sold.
Send us prequel memes.
Always send us prequel memes, please.
All right.
Yes.
All right, cool. Y'all, thanks.
All right, well, I think I've watched this sign off enough. So, bye y'all. Thanks.